Hello, welcome back to The Hopeless Romantic. I am your slightly sickly, slightly hoarse host, Austin Chant.
And I am your perfectly well, although knock on wood, co-host, Amanda Jean.
As we discussed in the intro to our last episode, this episode is going to be, I guess, it's similar to our old format, but a little different from our new format, in that this is a bit of a special episode, not to sound flippant, but this is going to be our special episode on what not to do in publishing and what's wrong with the whole thing.
This is our PSA, our after-school special on how not to fuck up real bad.
Yep. You were going to get, like, raring to go, fiery, pissed off Austin. We were ready to sort of, you know, leap into that after all of the shit events that's been going on. And then I immediately got very sick. So now you're getting week later, sort of grim, hoarse, still angry, but in a somewhat more, a slow simmering fuse instead of a raging inferno, Austin.
I'm always a raging inferno. I just conceal it under very silly jokes.
Just to be clear, we're going to talk about not necessarily, because we can't necessarily comprehensively say this is exactly what is happening in all of the recent issues with Riptide Publishing and Santino Hassel and all that jazz. This is going to be an episode on a lot of the stuff that we have observed in connection to that and have personally observed that are structural things that are wrong and cultural things that are wrong in queer romance right now, and some possible solutions. Although, as we were discussing before the episode, a lot of it just boils down to, hey, don't do this.
Yeah, hey, knock it off. Smarter people have said smarter things about some of the specific issues that we'll be tackling, and wherever possible, I will link to them, especially if it has to do with something systemic like racism. Obviously, I'm not going to have all of the depth and perspective that I need on that, so I will fill out the show notes with a couple of links. But I feel like we can at least, from our perspectives, point out the things and talk about how publishers and authors can aggressively combat them.
Yeah.
So I suppose on that note, one of the major issues that has come up time and time again, leading to the We Need Diverse Books sort of movement and hashtag and situation, is that publishing is extremely gatekeepery and extremely white, and in queer romance, extremely cis. And almost entirely female in terms of people who are actually calling the shots and employing freelancers and on the publishing side of things. A lot of white, cis women. I'm trying to think off the top of my head the number of editors of color I've worked with, and there's maybe three. There aren't many. And I was thinking about this, and I realized that some of them were not developmental editors. They were copy editors or proofreaders, and those are extremely valuable skills, but they are frequently paid less than dev editors and are kind of looked at with less prestige than dev editors, developmental editors.
They tend to have also less power to, say, send a book back and say, this is really offensive and we need to not publish this, or this needs to be sensitivity read. That power rests way more with acquiring and dev editors.
And that actually dovetails really nicely into a connected bit, which is that in the wake of so many publishers getting feedback like We Need Diverse Books and seeing that they've made mistakes that people have kindly pointed out to them, one of the things that some publishers instituted were sensitivity readers or sensitivity editors. And the main problem I have with that is that they come into projects way too late. They need to be implemented in the acquisition stage before you even send a contract for the book or send an offer for the book. Because I know that I'm not always able to spot hugely structurally problematic elements of books because of my privilege. And I work as an acquisitions editor, and I don't like playing that kind of roulette, and I don't like passing the buck on to editors later in the chain, especially if the rest of them are also white. And that's also not the only intersection of diversity that I'm worried about. Like, this happens with trans books. This happens with books about neurodivergent people. Like, it happens about a lot of different topics, and that can't just be fixed by hiring, or it can't be fixed by contracting a sensitivity reader who may not actually come on until later and may not understand how to edit and how to give editorial feedback.
Yeah, and maybe getting to it at a point where it's like, okay, you're basically here to do a copy edit, but for, you know, offensive, like, garbage bombs in this manuscript.
Yeah.
Versus this needed to be, this book maybe needed to not be published at all.
Or deeply gutted and restructured.
Yeah. A lot of times, I mean, we've seen cases as well where sensitivity editors then get blamed when offensive books still go out because their feedback wasn't incorporated or, you know, it wasn't enough. They couldn't absolutely change the trajectory of a story that was already sour. I think sensitivity editing is extremely valuable and very important, but it doesn't replace two things. It doesn't replace having, you know, that power at the acquisitions level, having editors of color and acquisitions editors of color there to vet stuff, you know, long earlier. And it also doesn't replace books by the marginalized people being represented.
Nope. There's so many things that it's a band-aid for, and it's not always the best suited band-aid. I've come across this when people have rightly come after books that have had some unaddressed problematic content, and the author or the publisher will say, well, it had a sensitivity editor, or maybe even had two. And it's like, well, when were they put on this manuscript? Because your author does not have to take these changes. They're usually not contractually obligated to. They can maybe delete something if they were told it was a slur, but if they're like, hey, this entire character is a racist caricature, they're kind of at liberty to cut it or not cut it. And sometimes the publisher, you know, they're this far along in the process, and not every publisher is going to stick to their guns and say, yes, absolutely, you need to make this huge change right when we're going, like, we're on NetGalley. Like, so in addition to all of these things that sensitivity readers are frequently not in a position to fix, may not be trained to fix, and that one person's lived experience is not the same as another, so things can obviously slip through, they're usually underpaid or not paid at all. I know that I was looking at some of the rates, especially for this level of emotional labor, right? Like, if you do get a sensitivity editor who has a solid background in structural editing and they're reading a manuscript looking for minefields with which they could hurt themselves and telling you very nicely how to fix it, they should be paid the same as I'm paid as a developmental editor for a pass. Like, it should just be the same. And I realize that not every press can or will do that, but that needs to be the goal to run toward. It shouldn't be you get paid less than a proofreader or the same as a proofreader.
Part of what could solve the issue of pay is a lot of these books shouldn't be contracted to begin with. You know, there are a lot of books that make it really far through the process that should never have been contracted at all. And if publishers were faster about catching those, they'd be wasting a lot less money. Yeah, I just remembered that one of the, probably the worst, most offensive trans books that I've read in this genre, which I guess I won't name, but I sure could. It claimed to have, like, a lot of sensitivity readers on it. Like, I don't remember the number, but it was some absurd, giant number. And the author definitely trotted them out to be like, oh no, thank you to all of my many transes who definitely loved this book.
My plural trans who showed up to meet the firing squad on my behalf.
It's not a catch-all, and it's not a replacement for publishing better books, and also employing and publishing more of the marginalized people you're trying to get sensitivity readers for.
Yep. And I remember Rebecca Weatherspoon had talked about this on Twitter a couple of times, like, having been told by an agent or a publisher, I can't remember which, that, oh no, we're not interested in your work, but we would love you to come on and sensitivity read for us. And that is the most fucking insulting example of what this industry can be like. It's like, oh yeah, of course we're going to want to, like, tackle diversity quotas and write, you know, even well-meaning people are like, yes, I will write a character of color or two. Two people in this book might not be white. And so, you know, they're doing their research and their due diligence as much as they can. And it's like, yep, that's the model we want. It's just a bunch of white people trying as hard as they can instead of actually publishing more authors of color and not just being like,
yeah,
no, you can do the drudgery that you're, like, underpaid for. You can absolutely do that, but we don't want your books.
Yeah, it's just such a microcosm of the whole issue. It's just like there's like a fundamental shift that needs to happen, and it is not a shift towards having underpaid sensitivity readers on every book.
No, or just not having them because, you know, it's like, oh, we're still coming across these problems. It's like, yeah, it's a fucking, you know, baked in systemic issue. It's not going to just go away overnight. You need to start by implementing these changes. And having talked about the pipeline and talking about how sensitivity readers and editors are same thing. Sensitivity editors are underpaid. I wanted to talk about the state of payment in the queer romance industry. And I'm going to tackle this as a person who has worked for a bunch of publishers, so many, to the point where I truncate my resume now. I've worked for a bunch and I've done every level of editing you can basically do. And I can tell you that there is no agreed upon market rate in this industry. There's absolutely none. Sometimes copy editors and proofreaders are paid fairly. Sometimes even dev editors are paid fairly. You have a situation where editors are paid a basically subhuman wage at a lot of publishers. And to make ends meet, especially if you're like me and you're trying to do this full time, you will take on way more work than you should. And that is something queer publishing and I suppose independent, like indie presses, needs to tackle, is getting some sort of a posted rate put on your websites, like when people apply, because I've definitely found maybe two or three websites where they'll actually state the pay range for paying editors. And that ties into the fact that editing is treated like a necessary evil in some cases. I've seen, especially at a lot of author mills, I mean, obviously a symptom of an author mill is that they're not going to have extremely skilled editing. But I've seen in a lot of author mills, just someone wrote an email to them and said, hello, I can edit. And mm-hmm. They're employed. But even worse than that is when you have like a respectable press who publishes good books and they don't pay a competitive or living or acceptable wage to their copy editors and their proofreaders. And look, I like Dream Spinner. They publish a lot of authors that I'm fans of, and overall they have a pretty decent pipeline. But as far as I'm aware, the last time I checked into this, which was fairly recently, they still don't pay proofreaders. I believe proofreaders are offered a discount on upcoming titles. I don't know that for sure, don't quote me. But their proofreaders, in effect, are not paid. And I suppose it's sort of the mindset of like, well, you're getting to read these books ahead of time for free. Yeah, it's still work and it still needs to be paid. And instances like this where proofreaders are not paid or copy editors in other presses or other situations just makes this industry all the more broken and all the more hostile to talent and all the more amateur.
Yeah, and I was going to say, and that also just feeds into the further marginalization of marginalized voices in the community, because that limits who can afford to be employed as an editor in this genre, because you have to work really, 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 really hard just to make any kind of living wage. And if you're an editor of color or a trans editor, I imagine there are going to be a lot of instances where you're going to be dealing with microaggressions, you might be denied work, and that might make it completely unlivable. And not only that, but then when you have a situation where editors are being forced to take on as much work as possible just to survive, the less and less work they can put into ensuring that the manuscripts that do go out have been vetted for potentially vile content and so on and so forth. It's just all part of us. It's all symptomatic of problems that I don't know how much we've discussed them on the podcast before, but I know you and I have talked a lot about a lot of just amateurism in queer romance, yeah. Which is it feels like a mean way to put it, but it is actually a huge problem, I think, that there is this lack of treating the genre as professional work and not hobby work.
Yeah, it's not hobbyism.
Because I think if you can justify like paying your editors way, way less than editors should be paid because, oh, you know, it's just a side gig.
It's like, well, I can't afford to pay them that. I just want to put out my manuscript. Like, well, then you can't afford to to self-publish.
And to me, that all ties into the lack of professional boundaries that we have also seen as a huge problem in the cases that have come forward recently. I don't know, for folks who have not I guess, dive full on into what happened at Riptide, the managing editor was extremely inappropriate with authors. A lot of people have come forward to say that she was inappropriate with them. Sexually inappropriate, just, you know, a whole lot of boundaries being crossed in very uncomfortable ways. Feels to me, I'm not going to speak for what exactly was going on in this case because I wasn't there and I don't know the people involved that closely, but it feels similarly to instances that I have seen of just not treating this like a professional setting where people deserve to have the kind of boundaries that you would normally see between like an employer and their boss. Mm-hmm. Just not a recognition that that is the dynamic at play. If you are somebody's editor and they're your author, you need to not treat them like somebody that you can have casual sexual conversations with. I mean, you shouldn't treat anybody that way. You shouldn't treat anybody that way without knowing that they're okay with it. But I think there's a real, there's a treatment of this genre as like a play space.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from a lot of places. I think part of it is that so much of it grew out of fandom, which also has some of those boundary problems. I love fandom, but less power imbalances. And then you bring it into this environment where you have very, very high stakes for the folks at the bottom of the hierarchy in terms of power, stakes in terms of their careers and their creative work that they have worked so, so hard on, to then be put in a position where this person who has total power over whether that book goes out, whether it goes out with
a good cover and good marketing.
A good cover, good marketing. And then that person is subjected to extremely inappropriate behavior by their editor. And that's not recognized as abuse by an employer.
And who do you go to? Like, yeah. It's the editorial director in that case. And in similar cases, you know, it's been somebody so high up on the pipeline that who do you say, hey, this is an issue to? Who would you feel safe confiding in?
And I think, unfortunately, as we saw with Riptide, like, the issues are often systemic. The issues, because a lot of this industry is founded out of close relationships between friends and things like that. Oftentimes, as far as I'm aware, like, you know, the whole editorial staff is friends. And that lack of oversight and professional distance and boundaries can create some real, very scary issues for folks who are not part of that in-group or who are at danger of, you know, being ostracized from then an entire publishing structure.
I know that there's a whisper network, right? To say, sort of say like, hey, steer clear of this person, or hey, I had a bad experience with that person, or, you know, be careful of publisher Y because they won't market your book. If you're publishing people of color, they won't market your book as heavily, or whatever the case may be. But like, that isn't recourse, right? That is a self-perpetuated and maintained desperate attempt to steer others away from harm. And that can't be the only thing we have. The complete lack of like available HR in queer romance at publishers is honestly staggering, especially since you mentioned so many of them end up being friends, or at least came into it as friends or ended up friends and ended up sort of like a clique, I've noticed, which is always mm-hmm. funny to me, in that it sort of reflects a lot of what I think fandom did bring to the table. Because, I mean, not everybody who's in queer romance has had extensive experience with fandom or comes to it with that background and perspective, but frankly, quite a few do. And when those lines get blurred and you don't manage to effectively separate the two, you can cause real harm to people. This isn't something that you do for fun that has no consequences for others. I mean, you'd think that people at the top would at least know that, but apparently not.
And the thing too, I think, is that like, these people were probably going to cause harm no matter where they were at. But when you put them in a situation where they're now in a professional position as well, the amount of harm they can do is magnified tremendously.
Yeah.
When you have somebody as an editorial position, or if you have somebody like Santino Hassel, who was a very respected author with a lot of backing, the amount of harm that person can do is just like way beyond. They have a platform, they have protection, they have all these things that they wouldn't necessarily have, and it increases the pressure on the victim so much to, you know, let it be swept under the rug.
Because who's going to believe them?
Yeah.
Who do they talk to? Who's going to believe them?
we have no, you know, aside from events like this where something blows up on Twitter, we don't really have a way to mediate and deal with, you know, these conflicts that ensures safety for the people who need it most.
Santino was incredibly popular and incredibly well-liked, or so it seemed on the surface. That's unfortunately another side effect of what can happen in this industry, is that authors and other creatives or people in the publishing industry are put on a pedestal. Look, I am fans of a great many people. I don't know if y'all have listened to the C.S. Picat episode or the K.J. Charles episode.
I was about to mention K.J. Charles.
I don't know if y'all have listened to those episodes, but go and listen to them, because we're big nerds who really, like, fanned out on them. But at the end of the day, like, I just think C.S. Picat is talented, and she was nice to me. Like, I think K.J. Charles is talented and nice to me. They're not infallible. They're just people. They're people who have a particular skill, and I'm, in many cases, buying their work, right? Like, this is a service they have provided to me, and I get to enjoy it.
To put it in the to put it in the most sterile terms possible.
Right.
I have enjoyed your service.
Thank you for your service.
But in many cases, that's what it is. I was about to bring up K.J. Charles, actually, because she talked about this issue, I think, very eloquently, just in terms of, like, we should not be giving authors this sort of, like, extra level of credibility or cult of personality just because they
did a thing well,
write good stuff, because they're not any more credible or trustworthy than anybody else. I think, as she put it, we also lie for a living. So don't give us any extra credibility. You know, in the case of Riptide, this was a case of a publisher and an editorial staff, like, abusing authors for the most part. I wouldn't be surprised if editors as well. As the case with Santino Hassel showed, that can obviously happen with authors as well, going after other authors or readers, bloggers, you know, basically anybody who doesn't have that amount of social capital and their position. I think it's just something that we have to be really aware of when people are given that sort of extra power. That's kind of power that nobody should have, power to shield themselves from criticism.
Santino's case was so spectacularly indicative of the background that I at least come from, having, I mean, I started fandoming when I was, what year was it, like 1998, 1999, maybe even before then, who knows, time is a flat circle. And just the particular stages of fandom that I went through and the fandoms I was in prepped me to be able to see this for what it is. And it's sort of that BNF culture, or if you are not familiar, big name fan culture, where someone is...
Amanda lived through Harry Potter fandom.
Amanda lived through some shit. Amanda lived through Supernatural. Amanda lived through Harry Potter. Amanda lived through Glee! But I more importantly lived through a lot of, like, the really big fandom upheavals in the LiveJournal era. And this, when the Santino thing, when I started hearing more and more about different victims speaking out and saying, like, Santino specifically ostracized me, and Santino would speak very poorly of such and such and try to have people abandon them, but would then court them on Twitter or end up writing a book with them in some cases. And that, to me, just rang so strongly of this very strange cult of personality and manipulation that I encountered and sometimes was part of back in ye olden times on the live journals. it came as no shock to me that Santino Start had also been on live journal. Like, obviously, Santino is an abuser, but, like, this is somebody who went, aha, this skill works for me and this way of navigating the world works for me. And then took that deep dysfunction and that tactic of abuse and learned how to divide and conquer, usually in private, right? Like, it wasn't always public. A lot of the nastier stuff was in, you know, group chats or one-on-ones. And I would, as a warning to readers and fellow authors and fellow people in this industry, if somebody seems to be extremely nice on their social media, but the minute that they talk to you, they start digging for gossip, or the minute they talk to you, they start airing their grievances, possibly just back away from that. It's not a healthy atmosphere. And on top of that, you don't know to what end this is happening. You don't know what their purpose is in doing that. It's a pretty unhealthy signal, which I think may be difficult for some people to notice that is even happening, especially if you really, really like the author and you think, oh, cool, I've befriended so-and-so and now they're telling me like all the cool things about publishing that I didn't know, or they're confirming my suspicions about, you know, this side of publishing. And I don't think that that is the healthiest place to be. That is my personal advice based on a lot of time learning these lessons.
Yeah, Amanda's been in the trenches. Amanda has seen.
I've dug my own grave and dug myself out of it.
Yeah. I also wanted to talk a little bit about, it can be easy sometimes to see the like extreme cases like Sarah Lyons and Santino Hassel and be like, okay, those are the abusers.
These are what they look like, right?
These are what they look like. But I wanted to talk about sort of how we all should be navigating boundaries, because I think there are, like I was saying, like because so many of us came from fandom or have been now enmeshed in this new culture that maybe came partially from fandom but is its own thing, I think there are a lot of minor infractions happening all the time. From my perspective, as a relatively small-time author who has not, I haven't had necessarily the platform that someone like Santino Hassel has had, but I still have had, I think, the capacity to do harm. And I can't say for sure whether I have personally managed to mitigate that, but I can say that, like, ways that I have tried to, and power dynamics that I try to remain aware of. I think it is really, really important for authors to recognize how easily that kind of cult of personality springs up, not only on a broad scale, but in one-on-one interactions. Authors need to practice really, really good boundaries with readers and fans, and also anybody else. And that may mean cutting off certain relationships and being really careful how things develop, because there's a power dynamic there, whether you want there to be or not. I mean, I think it can be weird for folks who are in indie publishing, you know, very small time, very small, you know, small press, queer indie publishing. It can feel like, oh, well, we're all friends. We're all just part of this same community. It's fine. But it's like, no, if you are in a position of power and authority, if you have written somebody's favorite book and now they're reaching out to tell you that it changed their life, you need to be really, really careful about how you approach that dynamic, and not abuse the power that their affection for your work has placed in you. I think the thing to recognize there is that outside of certain cases where a fan is like stalking or you know, being creepy,
incredibly intrusive
to an author, most of the time the onus is going to be on the author to not abuse someone. And I mean very seriously, like that's a power that you have to take very seriously. Like, I've had fans flirt with me. I have had a lot of people message me, you know, privately to say, oh, I liked such and such about your book. And the onus is on me in that dynamic to be like, not to shut that down in the case of somebody, you know, reaching out to say, I liked your
complimenting,
book.
Complimenting, yeah.
Shut down the flirting, because that's, you know, that's a power dynamic that is not okay.
Yeah, and I feel like we need to, I mean, I need to be clear in that, like, obviously authors can make friends with readers,
yeah.
But you should not be fostering a relationship that is based in a power imbalance. Like, you should not be like, a reader comes to you in your DMs and is like, your book touched me, and here's some personal info about me. And then as an author, you should say, I appreciate that very much, and end it there. Like, do not go digging for more information. Do not disclose information of your own. If this is something that, you know, maybe they've disclosed something painful, you can say, here are some resources that I have used or found helpful or whatever. But I really do feel like, because our instinct as human beings, especially when we're looking at our creative work as an extension of ourself, is to engage wholeheartedly with readers who we see as basically like us, like, ah, yes, this person liked this thing that I wrote and had this thought about it, and they wanted to talk to me about it. Like, yes, that's all well and good, but we have inherited a wonky dynamic and a wonky system of power, and we need to be aware of that in every situation. And like, I can't say that I've always been 100% aware of that, because obviously I'm human. But once I'm in a position where if I'm aware that I'm talking to someone who is or may be a client, an author that I'm working with, I put up boundaries immediately. And even in some cases with somebody who I don't think I'll work with, or you have to aggressively monitor your own human instincts to reach out and forge like a deep emotional connection with somebody one-on-one, because that can so quickly lead to, I don't want to say exploiting,
it's I think it's what it is exploiting is a sort of a false, I think there's a false sense of connection there that the connection has like it disguises the power dynamic at play.
Because it's an absolutely real thing that you may feel an instant kinship with somebody over DM, but when you are in the position of power over them, please be careful. Please monitor your boundaries. It's so easy to slip into inappropriate behavior with somebody and not realize it. They might not even realize that it's happening.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of times the fact that that dynamic is so often at play makes it really, really hard for victims to then speak out when that dynamic does turn very bad. And it does turn very bad, like on a pretty regular basis. And I think that's why it's important to be really careful how you engage and to like cultivate a sense in yourself of, is this appropriate or not? Is this exploitative? One other thing I was going to say, but my mind is a sick sieve.
Did we want to talk about convention culture?
Yeah, let's briefly talk about convention culture, because we both like conventions and having a good time.
It's very, very easy to slip into a comfortable, for you, atmosphere and not realize that you are trampling over people's boundaries and comfort so severely. I can't tell you the amount of times that, and this extends to fandom, this is every convention I've ever heard of, the amount of times that belatedly someone will come to somebody else or a whisper will go down the rumor mill. It's like, hey, that thing that you did at the bar in the middle of X con was deeply inappropriate and I had to go to my room and like not engage with the rest of the convention. An example I have is like, if you're in a public space, like wearing dick hats, talking extremely explicitly about sex and your own sex life to strangers.
The general sort of culture of like, we're all having a good time and these are the wild, fun, you know, very extra usually, things we do.
Yeah.
Very often it makes it really hard for people to opt out of that.
Yeah, they just have to leave or just sit there and be, you know, continually made uncomfortable and traumatized.
And I think a lot of times, like, these issues come up in queer romance, not necessarily more than at other conventions, but a lot of authors are kind of pent up and don't do a whole lot of socializing and then do it all at once at conventions. And also, this is a genre where it tends to be represented by cis women, by white cis women, and it tends to be about not white cis women, and I think that creates a whole new realm where it can get very uncomfortable to have a bunch of drunk women, like, heavily sexualizing queer men in a variety of ways. Penis hats, kind of an example of that, to be honest. Like, it starts to feel a little, I don't even know what the word is, but dehumanizing. I mean, I know I would not be comfortable in that dynamic just as somebody who doesn't like to party that hard and is kind of withdrawn.
So I love to party hard and have a good time, but I feel like usually these things are taking places in hotels or conference meeting spaces. And sometimes they're in individual hotel rooms and like a lot of people would be crammed into a suite. You know, if you're out and about in the general hotel and you're wearing like dick hats and talking above a very, you know, contained volume about like sex, about explicit issues, about the industry or whatever, you need to be aware of the situation you're in. Like, you could be not only stomping on the boundaries of people in your party, so to speak, but also just random ass strangers who were wandering by. I know that there have been cases where bar staff, hotel staff have had to come to specific groups and say, please, can you lower your voices? Please, can you, you know, cut such and such content from your speech because you are entering the space of other human beings who did not sign up for this. And I feel like it's one of those cases where you need to do checks with people, like just realistically say, you know, hey, is everybody down to talk about smut? Hey, those of us who are comfortable talking about kink are going to go off and do this thing.
Yeah, I think that honestly, I think that's the better option because like you have to do the work of containing yourself because oftentimes just being like, hey, is everybody cool with this? You're putting the people who are
putting the onus on one person to be like, no.
Actually, no. And then you're like, okay, scrub, get out of here. Like, when it's like, no, if you want to have a conversation that you know is sort of like generally not okay to shout at volume. Self-contained, you know?
And I realize it's made more difficult by the fact that frequently people are drunk, which is also potentially a boundary crosser for some people. I've certainly been in situations at conventions where people have hit on me or said inappropriate things to me while I'm drunk. And like, I can shrug most of that off. It's for me personally been fine, but I know for every story where it's just like, nah, it's fine, there's stories where someone has been incredibly hurt or harmed or victimized. So if you know that you're the sort of person to get extra silly and to forget what boundaries are when you drink, don't drink at a convention, or drink with your like two best friends who you already like understand their boundaries of, and they're 100% down for it.
I think it just goes back to this, like, this genre is not your personal playground. It can be a fun place. It can be a great community. We're not, I mean, obviously we run a goofy podcast where we talk about description a lot. We're not here to be like the fun police, but that's not the same as not harming other people. There is a major problem in this genre of not being able to respect other people's boundaries and safety in the name of having a good time, which is shitty, really bad. I don't know any other way to put it. Like, we need to have a recognition that we can have a fun, good space and also have professional boundaries and respect each other's comfort zones. It's not that hard. It's not that hard to maintain a modicum of sense about how you treat other people, but so often it just does become that, like, I'm gonna have a good time. And then when you couple that with privilege and with general representation not being by marginalized people, maybe the fun you're having is not only not appropriate, but maybe parts of it are fundamentally bad and disrespectful to other people, and you need to think about that.
What's drawn to mind is, and I should look this up to be certain of it, but fuck it, I'm off the cuff here. Do you remember that convention? I think it was in Europe, may have been in the UK, where there was a dinner and they were served by like half undressed like male waiters. I don't know if they were models.
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah, and there's situations where, like, they'll do, like, conventions will have, like, cover shoots with, like, adult film actors. If you're already showing up to a convention where you're talking about the sexuality and intimacy and experiences of an identity that is not your own, maybe it's not a hot look to, like, literally pay people to be eye candy for you to ogle. Maybe that's not a hot look.
Yeah, I have very mixed feelings about that.
I know, I do too. It's an interesting thing where I'm just like, I guess for size, fine.
I feel like we should clarify. We have no problem with the adult film actors. I have a problem with them being exposed to a situation in which I think it is highly likely they are going to be treated inappropriately by the guests.
I don't want them to be groped because of their profession. I don't want them to be treated badly because of their profession. I have no problem with their profession itself. Yeah, it's a weird situation where I'm like, well, I want them to have, you know, work if they want it, but I also don't want them to have to put up with this shit. Convention culture is pretty symptomatic of some of the boundary issues and the just lack of understanding the harm you can do to others while you're having fun, because it's not fun for everybody.
Boy, we're having fun today, aren't we? This is the grim.
We're having fun. And also, I should state, you mentioned, like, yeah, we have this podcast where we make description jokes a lot, but also we use trigger warnings, and all of our episodes are labeled explicit.
Because we don't want to hurt people. Like, it's that simple. Yeah. I think this is what, you've got a little bit of the rage Austin back. He's back. He's back in the saddle.
He's here.
Just so much of this, I mean, a lot of this does, I don't want to minimize that a lot of this comes down to shit like racism, like, and just straight up white people being inappropriate and that kind of thing. A lot of it to me also comes down to just don't fucking treat people this way. Don't do this to people. Take a look at yourself, own your shit, don't ever treat people this way. What infuriates me about the specific cases that have come forward is these are people who, by all accounts, I think knew better, had plenty of warning signs about their own behavior, knew that they were hurting people, and chose instead to keep doing what was entertaining for them and what would sustain them, and never taking the time to reflect and say, let's not do this. I don't know as much about the backstory with Santino Hassel, but I do know with Riptide, this shit came up 2 years ago, and it came up before then in previous instances. Like, they had time to learn and do better. And they didn't. They chose not to. They decided it was not important enough to them to stop harming people.
Especially with Riptide. Like, Riptide had a reputation, and much of that was self-perpetuated, as being unlike a lot of other queer romance presses. Like, they were the sort of New York style publishing outfit that was going to, you know, it was super selective and everybody was super skilled. And like, that may be true, but also, like, if you're going to be putting yourself on any sort of professional pedestal, your shit better be professional from top to bottom. And it wasn't. Like, they managed to completely botch the first instance of people saying, hey, this is some racist shit, fix it. They botched the second one, they botched the third one, and then they even had their editorial director specifically being racist and harming people. Like, I don't think what could have been clearer, a fucking blinking neon sign. I just keep coming back. There's two things in the Riptide situation, and I don't want to completely harp on the Riptide situation because it is one of many and it's just an example. But the two things that keep playing in my brain on a loop are, one, when Sarah Lyons had the fucking temerity and gall to say, like, ah, yes, we have no problem with POC or whatever it was. I'm going to look it up.
I think that might be the literal quote, though.
I think it is. It's like with a winky fucking face after it. I'm finding this. I'm sorry. I'm mad now because I think about it and I can't imagine ever saying that to anyone. Ever. Oh, here we go. And no, we don't mind POC. Fucking winky face, followed by hating having to say that we won't put them on the cover because we like the book to, you know, sell, sad face. But we do use it as a talking point for every library push we do.
Yeah, like, there's just so many layers of bullshit there. And this was all, as far as I'm aware, like, very near to or after the event in 2016, it sucks to even call it an event, they put out a racist book, it sucked, and got rightfully called on it. 2 years later, they're still saying, oh, you know, it takes time to fix your book. It's like, it doesn't take that long. Like, that could have been, you know, with the apology they gave last time, I was willing to give them the benefit of the doubt of, like, okay, yep, they're gonna do some structural changes and unfuck this. And at the time I was hopeful and I looked up to them, but 2 years later to still be saying, like, oh yeah, I guess we've got a clean house now. It's like, no, you needed to clean house so long ago and you needed to take it seriously.
This press, which again was calling for diverse voices, marginalized voices, had the temerity to say, like, we want stories by authors of color, we want stories about people of color, but, like, we're not gonna put your ass on the fucking cover because it doesn't sell.
Which is the shittiest, falsest,
most... It's also fucking not true.
It's not true, and it's also the most self-perpetuating thing. Like, this is a press with a lot of publishing power and marketing power saying, oh, we're not even gonna try. But don't worry, we're going to cover our asses by saying, well, it wouldn't sell if we did. Not that we attempted it.
The other thing that pissed me off re-Riptide was the official Riptide statement, which said, it had the quote, romance is an intimate business, I think. And I've been mad about that for 10 years, even though it only happened like 6 days ago. But yeah, just the fucking audacity. Nudge and like try and sort of shrug it off as like, oh, well, you know, this is, the industry tends to... Like, the industry is somehow gray. Like, no, one, it's not hard to not victimize your authors with explicit sexual harassment. And two, it's not that hard to monitor your editors and your staff because you work remotely. Yeah, but I think we can do it relatively quickly. Now that we've lathered ourselves into a fury, do you want to talk about some other signs of dysfunction in queer romance?
Yeah, so I think the rest of this episode, we're going to talk about some stuff for people to beware. And obviously the onus is still on people to not be terrible, but we wanted to give some sort of warning signs for authors in particular to protect themselves from other situations, because right now a lot of folks are leaving Riptide. A lot of folks may have had contracts fall through and are looking for other options at this point. And it would suck to run away from an abusive press and into the hands of another. Just because a press hasn't had an immediate scandal does not mean they're necessarily good or have your best interests at heart. So we wanted to talk about some blaring warning signs that you can avoid.
So first I'm going to talk about some signs that you may be looking at a deeply dysfunctional press or an author mill. An author mill is just like quantity over quality with some other dysfunction thrown in for kicks. So some of the signs you'll see are just a lot of books released very frequently, like week by week. They're just throwing them out onto the public. Many of them are by brand new authors. They have, like, if you're submitting to them, they have extremely fast acquisition, and their contract terms are pretty fast. Or, like, let's say you are partially through the editing process, and it's, like, taken 2 months and your book's about to come out. Like, that seems excessively fast, especially if it's a novel. Really fast editing, especially if you have only had contact with, like, point of one editor. I mean, that's not really symptomatic of anything on its own. Frequently, you will really only have contact with one editor or see one editor doing something until, like, later stages. But I feel like if you're already in a situation where things are iffy, you maybe look at how many people are actually looking at your story. When you look at their books, there's bad editing and terrible formatting. When you Google them, there are a lot of complaints. Their contract terms, like their royalty rates, are extremely unrealistically high, like above, I don't know, 50 or 60%. Is impossible unless you're doing some sort of self-publishing. They're making anyone who tries to make you pay out of pocket for anything is not where you want to go, especially if they're like, hey, if you pay $25, you can be entered into this thing for an obscure award or maybe in this content. No, fuck that.
If a press asks you to pay for anything, I would immediately treat that as a massive red flag.
Yeah, and especially if they ask you to pay for author copies, never. I should specify here, though, like, paying for author copies is a no. Paying for additional copies of your book to sell at conventions or whatever at discount, yes. Most publishers will give you a discount to buy more copies of your book, but you should get some base amount free. That's just what happens. If when you're Googling them or looking them up on Twitter, you see a lot of people complaining about late payments, if they're bad about responding to your emails and addressing your concerns, if they don't let you negotiate your contract even a little, if they have any failure to meet contractual requirements in general, if their reputation is almost non-existent also, like, how new are they?
And there's a resource, right? Isn't it Writer Beware?
There's Writer Beware, Absolute Right.
These are just forums and websites that keep a record of.
Yeah, and I'll link them in the show notes. And then I wanted to talk, because we specifically had someone ask about contract clauses that may be not in the author's best interest, and I will just straight up call some of these predatory. So we talked before about right of first refusal clauses, which is when a publisher who has contracted your book says, okay, in the contract, I get to look at your next project and say yay or nay, and you may not submit it elsewhere until I have said yay or nay. That's not on its own.
It's not always bad. Like, some legitimate presses do have that. However, if that is a thing you don't want to do,
consider that. And it's also, like, you know, sometimes you don't want to submit your, like, weird, kinky steampunk to your fluffy, sweet press, or vice versa. It's like, no, you don't even want this. Why are you asking me for it? Like, you won't even read it. Also look out for sort of vague non-competition clauses, because if they word it vaguely enough, they can seek damages from you or claim breach of contract if you, like, self. Also be wary of those clauses having an indeterminate amount of time listed. Like, if they're saying, please don't publish something with someone else for 6 months, that might be acceptable to you. But if it's, like, not specified in the contract, run.
I think just a general rule of thumb, again, this comes back to treating this as a professional space with professional boundaries. A contract should be interpreted as meaning the worst possible thing it could mean, because that's what it will mean in the hands of a predator. That's the situation, is, like, this is a professional contract for your creative work, and it should be there to protect your work. You should be very cynical about what it says in it.
Yeah, you should, if you can afford to, please send it to a contract lawyer or some sort of specialist. I realize not everyone can, so at least thoroughly read your contract and ask questions. Any sort of vague lack of numbers, like, there's not a clause that says we will publish this book within X amount of time, because then they will hold on to your fucking manuscript forever and not return the rights to you.
Extremely expansive rights, like the exclusive right to print, publish, sell, license the book in every format, in every language, in the whole world, forever. Anything like that.
Yeah, it's like book and movie. Like, every why do these presses need every single right you've ever had? Specifically, what does this press publish? I was also going to say, no publisher should ever take your copyright. And I honestly, when I was Googling around, I was like, people literally got away with that? Yeah. Apparently, publishers, scam publishers, predatory publishers have taken people's literal copyrights. You will always have the copyright to your work, or you should run screaming in the opposite direction.
Yeah, I think this may be a thing that people who aren't like contract sleuths don't necessarily realize. A contract is only ever a publisher licensing certain rights from you for a set period of time under very strict parameters. The book is yours, and the book should be yours forever. You are giving the publisher the right to use it in certain forms under very specific guidelines.
And you get paid for the privilege,
yes,
basically.
Exactly.
And you should, we talked about this in our Advice for New Authors episode, but we talked about royalty rates for digital and print. And I don't actually know as much about audiobook royalty rates, so shrugs. But yeah, basically, if there is just an indeterminate amount of time, unspecified, ambiguous, we don't want that. That is the enemy. Don't look for something that could hold your book, your rights in perpetuity and not publish your shit. You should always ask about your right to terminate the contract. Sometimes you'll have to buy out. Like, sometimes that just happens if you just decide, I don't want to move forward with this for whatever reason. Sometimes publishers will let you go, but frequently they will be like, okay, you need to buy out your contract. And sometimes that's just paying for cost of editing, paying for cover, paying for, like, maybe you got an advance, paying back the advance. So you always want to be really clear on when your rights revert, and you can always re-up. Sometimes the press will be like, hey, the end of your contract is coming up. Do you want to re-edit and republish this?
We're both in professional spaces, people who, you know, try to err on the side of politeness and caution. And a lot of this has just completely drained that out of me. I'm so mad. I'm so angry at people exploiting, you know, this industry being seen as less real or less serious and having less real consequences to do such terrible things. Be so completely cavalier with the creative work and personal safety and all of that of other people. It's just, it's atrocious, and you shouldn't do it. And that is my, if you, a bad person, have one takeaway from this episode, don't
go
do
away.
That.
Thank you for coming to our TED Talk. Go away.
Yeah. Also, I didn't mean to imply that our listeners are bad people. I'm sure most of you are, in fact, totally lovely. But if any of the bad ones are out there listening to this,
if they're listening to this to try and
out.
Find a way to be sneakier, we wanted to talk about, I mean, a lot of this is just don't do it.
Yeah, solutions
also,
beyond don't do it. Like some systemic solutions to go with our personal recommendations for how you behave.
I'll start out by saying what publishers need to do is aggressively court and go after non-cis and non-white staff and freelancers. Because at this point, if I were an editor of color, I would take a look at this industry and go, I am not welcome here. This is a hot fucking mess. No one's going to hire me for anything. And I wouldn't even bother applying. Like, that's just the state of things right now. Like, and in order for us to unfuck that, we have to aggressively, like, I don't mean like abusively go after somebody, but like look on LinkedIn, post your calls for job openings saying we're specifically seeking diverse editors and prioritize those applicants. And I realize, like, it's not, you can't just like ask someone what race they are, but if you're setting it up to where you're actively looking for editors of color, or you're maybe getting referrals, or people are see on your website that you're actively looking for diverse candidates, they may state themselves. They can self-disclose. And on that note, we already mentioned paying sensitivity editors a fair and comparable rate, but also instituting them at the acquisitions level and making sure they have an understanding of like structural feedback and stuff like that.
Like, so many problems I think would be solved if you had people on staff who were, you know, already knowledgeable to be like, we shouldn't acquire this, and just have the books
have that built in.
Have books that are potentially problematic always go through the right channels to be like, is this okay or is this not okay? Not okay? All right. We're not going to waste any more time and money on it.
We already mentioned that all presses need to get their asses in gear and start paying all stages of editing a fair rate, a market rate, and very few are. And okay, so we mentioned how to personally draw boundaries, and we mentioned some resources. So for potential authors and for, I guess, even readers, what you'll want to do is just Google the press and look through the pages of results and maybe add keywords such as problems, issues, controversy, lawsuit.
Yeah.
And then you can also, again, look on Absolute Right, Reader Beware. But in any case, I will link some of those resources. But honestly, it really is just a question of, like, did former disgruntled employees leave bad Yelp reviews? Well, some of them did. Are people on Glassdoor, like, saying, you know, saying things about the broken pipeline? Well, you should probably pay attention to that. Setting, you know, personal boundaries for interaction, we discussed that. And I do want to stress here, because a lot of what happened in the wake of when Christina Wright was called out for sexually harassing readers, and when Santino was initially called out, I shouldn't say initially, when Santino was called out for toxic, harassing, abusive behavior, so many instances of, well, I want to believe them, but this is anonymous, so, or just these reasons why, because you have a personal affinity for this particular author, that you just don't want to believe victims straight up. It's like, no, that my personal feelings about this person and my opinion of their persona and what I know of them tells me that this can't possibly be true. We have just seen the immensity of people in powerful positions who I'm sure many people would have never thought could have been abusers, could have been victimizing people, finally being called out, and, you know, many of them falling from grace and falling from their power, some not. And we had an entire movement. Time's Up and Me Too have an entire movement. And yet there are still defenders and there are still people saying, well, I personally never experience this or can't believe it. And I just got to tell you guys, like, we can't do that here. This is already such a delicate place, especially for marginalized people who may be victimized outside of queer romance. We don't need to re-victimize them all over again by refusing to believe victims. We don't need to make this worse. We need to address the problems that are making it easy for abusers to cross lines and shatter boundaries and victimize people. But we also need to immediately believe victims and try to save them from that fallout harm that so many people see, where they're just questioned and interrogated. And that can't be acceptable here. That it just can't. And so for this last part, I wanted to talk a little bit about what I'm doing, because I am an acquisitions editor at Less Than Three Press. And one of the things I did recently was reach out to people on Twitter and say, hey, if you are looking for a new press or interested in talking about your options, you can DM me and I'll talk to you. And I wanted to say explicitly here, too, that I was not doing that to shill for LT3 and, in fact, only mentioned it like once. So I have a lot of friends who work throughout queer romance and in some other industries. So I reached out to them and I asked, like, hey, are you guys looking for former Riptide authors who are trying to find a new home for their book? And I told people my personal experiences with them, or said, like, that this book may be a good fit for X Press because they have a good reputation with this. And I also specifically tried to reach out to other editors who were either editors of color or queer editors, just to make sure that I wasn't potentially sending someone into a situation where they would face the same sort of gatekeepy bullshit. So I've been trying to do that. And if you hear this and want to talk to me, feel free to DM me. My DMs are open. But because I am very openly the acquisitions editor at LT3, I wanted to say what I and the staff at LT3 are doing to try to combat some of this just systemic built-in nonsense. So I've been working with Samantha Durr, who's the managing editor over at LT3, and we're restructuring our pipeline. It's going to take a little while because we're going to have to figure out what's broken and figure out some solutions. But we know that it involves hiring sensitivity readers at the acquisitions level, just to do the thing we talked about, to spot books that may have overarching issues that can't be fixed with dev edits. We're going to be hiring more editors of color and specifically seeking them out. And we're going to establish a clear code of conduct for editors in terms of their interactions with authors and readers. We are in motion. I don't want it to seem like self-congratulatory or like I'm highlighting LT3, like, oh yes, this is what will happen, the bastion of standards. No, that's not what's happening. It's that it's just unacceptable for me personally to continue to gatekeep just casually the way that we have. Like, this has just made it more evident that changes need to be implemented and that they're going to be. And where I have power as a white cis woman and as a gatekeeper, you know, I've upheld the status quo and I have to try and mitigate that harm. And I hope, and I know LT3 hopes we can do our part to uplift authors and editors of color. So that's what I'm doing personally. And I'm also taking it upon myself to do a simple stuff like reading more authors of color. And when I read a good book by them, talking about it on social media, which is an important thing to do. I think a step that often gets skipped, I'm not just going to rate on Goodreads and go to bed. I'm going to say, hey, this book was really good. Or I'll talk about it here on THR.
Just to touch on the presses, I think I hope that we see this happen throughout the industry. And I think we should continue to mount pressure to see those changes and follow through on those changes throughout the industry. I want to see those kinds of statements all over the place. You know, I want to see admission of previous guilt and a clear path forward that prioritizes not only not doing harm, but doing good in the future.
Yeah. Not just mitigating the issues, but like improving. And I feel like it's also key, like this shouldn't only happen, like these moments of self-reflection and looking at what's broken or what we can do to improve. This shouldn't only happen when someone's been called out for something egregious. It should be something that we do on the regular, just doing a check-in and seeing where we're at, seeing if something can be fixed. Looking at our staff and seeing like, okay, what's the ratio here? Is it still majority white? Is it still majority cis? Is it still representative of how prohibitive this industry is for marginalized people to enter it? Like, there's already so many things in the way, like just the rates and the sort of adjacent to academic culture, which is its own fucking nightmare of gatekeeping that editing is. And we don't need to continue to perpetuate that if we can help it. So I think after, you know, the last hour and a half that Austin and I spent yelling and offering some solutions for change, I think that it pretty much wraps it up. But
thanks for joining us for the yelling hour, the yelling 90 minutes, actually, maybe more like an hour once
all the editing's done. Yeah.
We'll see. But in general, I think we're going to be back to our normal format next time. It will be more goofy in the future, but we had a lot of strong feelings about this and not a whole lot of stuff that we wanted to joke about in this whole situation.
It would feel disingenuous to come out and be like, let's make jokes about
how angry and mad we are. Ha ha! Giggle. But yeah, we hope this was informative or cathartic or something along those lines. Something. And I hope that next time we do this, my voice is less shot.
Yeah, you gonna drink some tea, buddy.
Hell yeah. If you'd like to continue this if you'd like to continue this conversation on social media, you can find us on Twitter. I am at Austin Chanted.
I am at Amanda H. Jean.
And that's our show, everybody.
This episode of The Hopeless Romantic was produced by Daria DeFora and Amanda Jean, with art by Keezy Young and music by Carly Ann Warden. If you want to continue the conversation, follow us on Twitter at TheHRPodcast, follow us on Facebook, check out our Patreon, and please rate and review on iTunes if you enjoyed.